Be continuing our study in Job chapter 38. Just to recap from last week, so we finished chapter 37 last week. We spent a little bit of time in chapter 38, getting through the first seven verses or so. But spent most of our time kind of laying some groundwork and context for God's response to Job and his friends. Some of the things we discussed were how when God appeared to Job and his friends in the whirlwind, it all got real in a hurry. You know, at that point, you know, up until then, there had been just debates and discussions and very much of a philosophical nature. But the time for that had passed. Now you're out of the philosophical realm and you are now in the presence of the Almighty. We talked a bit about God's tone. I believe that the reader is supposed to understand that God is not pleased with what Job and his friends have been saying. And he wants them to know that, which is why he's speaking the way he is. They have presumed to know things that they did not, which is, you know, evident if you go back and see what they say, but especially evident in what God says to them very specifically in these chapters. They were speaking about things they didn't have understanding of. And they used those presumptions about God and about the things that he had done and about how they defined God's character in their eyes and his motives in their eyes. They used those things as ammunition against each other to support and bolster their own arguments. So I think God's appearance here was to persuade them. And he was trying to persuade them to remember their place and to humble themselves. But I think there's also an implication that God is there to restore hope ultimately, especially as it pertains to Job, because God showed up. I mean, we can know that by the very fact that he showed up. He arrived there, which proved that he was invested in Job. He hadn't abandoned Job. Those were things that Job had questioned. And it also proved that he was there again to persuade and convict. He wasn't there to strike them dead. That wasn't why he appeared. If he wanted to just punish them instantly without giving them a chance to be persuaded, he could have done that, but that's not what he did. So he is there to make things right. He's there to set things right. That's why God appears. A little bit about the content that we talked about last week. You know, God's going to talk about his creation. He's going to talk about things that he created on the earth, but he's not there to give them a physics lecture. We talked about that a little bit, but he's going to address them at their level. He's going to use concepts that they would understand to make the points that he wants to make. Again, you know, think about his purpose for being there. His purpose for being there was to persuade them that they needed to remember their place and to be humble. He wasn't there to enlighten all of their misunderstandings that they had about how he did everything. That wasn't his reason for showing up. We also talked about how this section is still part of this book of poetry. Remember, Job is a book of poetry. So is it possible that God would have appeared and spoken in poetry to them as we have it recorded to us? I suppose it's possible. But what I have faith in is that whether or not God used these exact words that would have come out as poetry, that would have matched the rest of the book and how everyone else spoke, I have faith that God's preserved the lesson that he wanted his readers to take from it. And that's where I am on that. We talked a little bit about verses 1 through 7 in chapter 38, and I won't retread that. But, you know, obviously let me know if you have any comments or questions about it. In verses 4 through 7, God's speaking about laying the foundation of the earth and about how they didn't know who determined its measurements. We talked a little bit about that and about, again, being careful ourselves, not presuming to know too much. Maybe I've had some assumptions about how the creation happened that I need to just, at a minimum, separate what my assumptions are from what the text actually says. So there's a lot you can dig into. That's a deep rabbit hole, by the way, if you ever want to go down that path. Lots of things have been written about what was going on in the creation. They talk about God's locality, you know, him being on the throne, but also appearing in other places to people in various forms and how all that might work. And it's a lot of speculation. So just know that that's out there. But The point being, the reason it's out there is because people have a lot of questions about those things because it isn't obvious. So people have to, you know, try to speculate on a little bit. We need to be careful that we understand that's what we're doing when we try to go down that path. So we're going to start in verse 8. Were there any questions or comments I didn't get to last week or anything you guys had that you wanted to cover before we continue in chapter 38? Yeah, Kelly?
I was just kind of thinking about these questions and maybe we think about them for freedom. How many of these questions did God actually answer that he asked Job? He doesn't ask us all.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and again, you know, I think it's evidence that he's not there to teach them about all the things they don't understand. That's not why he's there. He's there to show them, remember who you are versus who I am. And there's other things happening too that we'll flesh out as we go. Anything else before we keep going? All right, so again, verses 4 through 7, he talked about laying the foundation of the earth. And let's just read that so it leads into verse 8, and we'll read through verse 11. Verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it, and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come, and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. So now in verses 8 through 11, the sea is being discussed, and you have this image, several images that God uses, and the one of the swaddling band is kind of interesting. He talks about this swaddling band for the seas, and you think of a swaddling band, and that's something that, you know, would imply, you know, care and love, right? I mean, if you see a mother who's carrying her child in this way. But I think it also implies a complete mastery, right? I mean, there's no question in someone's mind if you see a parent carrying their child this way, who's in charge, right? I mean, the baby is completely at the mercy of the parent in this way. And I think that's one of the images that he's trying to get across. So, you know, what would have appeared to Job and his contemporaries at that time as an untamable force, the seas, is like a small infant in the arms of the Almighty. So again, remember who you're talking to here. And I also think that this section, at least for me, it calls to mind Job's initial lament in chapter 3, because a lot of the same imagery is being used here in chapter 38 as Job used back in chapter 3, which again I think is evidence to God is very much responding to things Job said. And I see that connection being made here. Back in chapter 3, if you just want to jump back over there, right around verses 6 through 10, but like we can look at Job chapter 3, verse 10, just to stick with this imagery we're talking about now. Job is talking about his birth, how he wishes he hadn't been born. And let's just read verses 6 through 10 in chapter 3 again. In verse 6, he says, that night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Again, talking about the night of his birth. Let those who curse it, who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan, who, by the way, God's going to talk about as well. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of mourning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. So he uses that term that he had wished that his mother's womb had been shut. And had that, of course, happened, then he would not have been born. It would have prevented his own life. But now you have God in chapter 38 using very similar imagery. Just jump back over there. Job chapter 38 and around verses 8 through 10. When he says, who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? Very similar imagery that he's using there. So God is using this imagery to talk about controlling the waters after it had come forth, right? He's affixing boundaries for it. And the reason he's affixing those boundaries is to, why? To preserve life on land, right? So the ocean won't just go everywhere and wipe everything out. So you have God using the same imagery that Job used. Job uses it to talk about how he wishes that it would prevent life. God's using it to show how he's preserving life, and he's using the same imagery. So I see that as a response to Job's lament. And you have a similar thing going on back in Job chapter 3, verse 6, where Job's wishing for thick darkness to seize life is what he says, meaning to prevent it from happening. And then in this section in Job chapter 38, verse 9, God says, "I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band." So the image of thick darkness is used by both Job and God, but it's used for opposite purposes. In God's image, the thick darkness wasn't something that would seize life or prevent it, but rather it's something that is, it's like a swaddling band for the waters. It's something that gives you an image of something God's using to soothe and control, but also it's very, very life-giving type of imagery that he's using. And that he's got these oceans under his control, like that of an infant under the control of a loving parent. And then that, of course, leading to life being on land is safe from it. So I want to draw that kind of stuff out as we go, because I don't think it's a coincidence, because you have such similar imagery being used, but being used for almost the opposite effect, or to make the opposite point. I really think God's trying to turn a lot of Job's arguments around on their head in this. Kelly, you had your hand up?
Yeah, I was just going to make
Yeah. And you know, to go along with that, I don't think that in the point that I want to try to make as we go through, especially chapter 38 and then we get into chapter 39, I don't think God chose these images just kind of randomly. I think he chose them because they fit very much in with what Job had spoken, and they are responses to things that Job had used to get off track in his thinking. And I think he's resetting Job in his thinking. So this kind of stuff's going to be present all throughout this chapter. You know, God, I think, needs to show Job how he's used these examples incorrectly, and because of it, he's drawn some wrong conclusions about God as well as himself and what he should be desiring. You know, another example of this is, you know, in chapter 33, remember Job, we read how he cursed his birth, and he said, "Let there be no rejoicing at my birth. You know, let no songs be sung, no rejoicing happening at my birth." And then here in chapter 38, when God's speaking of creation, he specifically mentions about how the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy. So again, a lot of these same types of images being used, but to lead you down another path as to how God would use those. So let's keep going. Let's read verses 12 through 15. So in verse 12 of chapter 38, "Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked, their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken." So now you have God discussing how he commands the light. And he also mentions this idea of shaking out the wicked by the light. And I think this is yet another example of God perhaps answering one of Job's complaints. If we go back to Job chapter 24, and let's take a look at verses 13 and 17. So Job 24, verses 13 through 17, which reads, this is Job speaking. And again, in the context of this, chapter 24, remember Job is talking about how all these poor people are taken advantage of and driven out, and the wicked are not punished for it. Okay. So verse 13, he says, "There are those who rebel against the light, who are not acquainted with its ways and do not stay in its paths. The murderer rises before it is light, that he may kill the poor and needy, and in the night he is like a thief. The eye of the adulterer also waits for the twilight, saying, 'No eye will see me,' and he veils his face. In the dark they dig through houses. By day they shut themselves up. They do not know the light, for deep darkness is mourning to all of them, for they are friends with the terrors of deep darkness." So Job is speaking of these who are taking advantage of others, and they're committing all these sins, and they don't care anything about God, how they're doing their acts undetected. They're in the dark, and they've become acquainted with the dark, and that's the realm within which they operate, and they're not being exposed. But then here you have Job chapter 38. Remember, let's go back to here. God's now talking about commanding the morning and causing the dawn to know its place, that it might take a hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. So there's more going on here than just God talking about, "Hey, I made the sunrise today." He's talking about judgment upon the wicked. He's talking about how those acts that are being done in darkness will be exposed. And in verse 15, "From the wicked, their light is withheld and their uplifted arm is broken." So there's this whole kind of idea of judgment happening here as well. And I think that you're supposed to understand that when God's talking about the light shining, there is, you know, some implications of just the cosmological workings of the sun rising and all of that. But it also has to do with God sees what's going on. He sees what's happening, and he's going to do something about it. And that's completely the opposite of what Job was claiming back in chapter 24. Job was saying these things are happening, nobody sees it, and nobody's doing anything about it. And if I'm wrong, show me where I'm wrong. Remember, Job issued that challenge to his friends. So now you have God coming back using very similar imagery, but to prove to him that no, there is stuff going on here. I do see it, and judgment is coming. And the idea of the in verse 13 where he says, when he's talking about the dawn to know its place, that it might take a hold of the skirts of the earth. The idea of the skirts of the earth are the remotest, furthest edges of it. So it brings to mind the completeness and totality of God's knowledge of what's going on. He sees everything, even out to the remotest parts of the earth. He knows what's going on, okay? So again, and that implies that there will be judgment coming because he sees it and he knows it. So those things will be called into account. I just want to add verse 14, which reads, "It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment." I'm not sure what that means. The Septuagint has a very different rendering of that. It talks about God creating men from lumps of clay. So I'm really not sure what that means or how it fits. I could contrive an explanation, but I don't really know. So just so you know about that. Any questions or comments about any of that? What verse were you looking at?
Verse 14?
Yeah, I don't know. Sorry, I don't have a better answer. There's going to be another couple of verses like that, or I'm just going to say, I don't know. All right, let's keep going. Verse 16. "Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all of this." So on the surface, obviously Job doesn't have this knowledge that God has, and God's making that very plain. But this also kind of relates to, again, going back to Job chapter 3, Job's initial lament for deep darkness to cover him and for him to basically be drowned in the deep depths of the water. Now God is using that same imagery here. And I think that he's saying, like, Job, you don't even know what you're asking for. Like, you don't know anything about these things. And you're thinking that you're going to find comfort there away from me? You don't know what you're talking about, I think is the point that God's making to him. Verse 19, where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the paths to its home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. So verse 21, the ESV renders this in a way that sounds very sarcastic. It's not as sharp as that in other translations as the ESV presents it. Like, for example, the King James presents it as a rhetorical question. The King James says, knowest thou it because wast thou then born, or because the number of thy days is great? It's more of a rhetorical question, not just a what reads to me is like blasting him with sarcasm. But again, the distance between God and Job is evident here. Verse 22, have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on a land where no man is, on the desert in which there is no man, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the ground sprout with grass? Has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth? And who has given birth to the frost of heaven? The waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. So here you have a lot of images of weather and water and ice and these types of things. And I think that what you're going to see is, at least what I read into it, is very much what we're going to see a lot of in chapter 39. God's going to start talking about things that he's done that don't really seem to make a lot of sense. Like in this passage, he talks about he's brought rain upon a land where no man is, on the desert in which there is no man, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the ground sprout with grass. Well, if it's a wasteland and no one's out there, why? Why is it important to make it rain out there? Well, God does it. And I think there's going to be some other things, too, that we get in chapter 39. It's going to be like, why does it work like that? Why does the ostrich, for example, abandon her young? You know, and there's several examples like that that we'll look at. But the answer is, it may not be obvious to us. We may look at nature and it may not be intuitive as to why God's doing everything that he does. So let's just hold that in mind. There are things happening that don't really make a lot of sense. And of course, going back to this section here where he's talking about the weather and the ice and that type of thing, very much like Kelly's point, you know, the how of these happenings were a mystery to Job and his friends. But again, these are images that his friends have used. I mean, Elihu, although he's not specifically referenced in this rebuke at all, he uses some of these images as well. He talks about the storms and the lightning. He talks about the ice and how it prevents man from going out and doing things. And you have some of that referenced here, which is kind of interesting. So even though Elihu is not directly mentioned in this section, this seems to really work really well with some of the things that Elihu said, or seems to respond to it. So let's keep going, verses 31 through 33. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season, or can you guide the bear with its children? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on earth? So these are different constellations, I think, that he's talking about here. And I can't help but call to mind when Job talked about constellations back in chapter 9, if you want to turn back over there. In Job chapter 9, let's see where we want to start here. So Job's point in chapter 9, if you remember, just kind of big picture. We spent a couple weeks going through this, so there's a lot happening in chapter 9. But big picture was that Job is basically saying he's going to use a lot of these things as evidence of God's power and authority, and that if God were to disagree with something that is objectively right, who's going to call him into account for that? Because of God's power and his authority, he gets to decide what's right, even if it isn't what Job would determine to be objectively right. In other words, the implication is if God wants to change the rules, on what's right and what's wrong, who's going to stop him from doing that? That's one of the implications of Job's argument in chapter 9. And we talked about the dangers of going down that path. But here in chapter 9, he's talking about some of these great evidences of God's power in the context of how no one's going to be able to challenge God. And in verse 7, he says, "Who commands the sun and it does not rise? Who seals up the stars? Who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea? Who made the Bear and Orion and Pleiades and chambers of the south? Who does great things beyond searching out and marvelous things beyond number? Behold, he passes by me and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. Behold, he snatches away. Who can turn him back? Who will say to him, 'What are you doing?'" And it's a rhetorical question. No one's going to be able to tell God, "What are you doing? What's going on?" Because God gets to choose what he wants to do. And this image of God that Job is painting is one that is could be a little reckless. Like if God decided one day, like it seems like he's done in Job's perspective with his own life, that I'm going to treat Job, my righteous servant, well, and then one day I'm just going to change my mind, and now he's going to suffer. And he's going to keep suffering until I decide he doesn't want to suffer anymore. Job's trying to grapple with that being his reality, and he's saying, who's going to tell God he can't do that? But then Job's going to say, but I wish I could. I wish I could go in front of him and appeal to him. And maybe if he saw me face to face, he would change his mind. So this idea that, getting back to what we were talking about in chapter 38, Job's using these images of how God has set the ordinances of the heavens and he controls these constellations and their motions in the sky. This, and inherent with that is just the immense power of God to be able to do these things. That's evidence that you're not going to be able to convince him to change his mind. Look what he can do. You're not going to be able to convince him to change his mind. So back in chapter 38, and we were in verse 31, when God is now questioning, how much do you really know about these constellations, Job? How much do you really know? Do you really know what it's like to guide them in their season? To control the ordinance of the heavens? And if no, then why are you using that as an example of my character and who I am? Again, you don't know what you're talking about. You're using these examples of things that I do to make your points about what I think and what I feel. But you don't even understand these examples that you're using. You don't know what it's like to actually bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion. So I think that's what he's getting into there. And then in verse 34, we'll just go ahead and, we'll read through verse 38 in chapter 38. He says, "Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, 'Here we are'? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Or who can tilt the waterskins of the heavens when the dust runs into a mass and the clods stick fast together?" So, again, I think it's another example of God kind of putting Job in his place and reminding him who he is. I'll note that verse 36 is a subject of much debate and differences of interpretation. And the translations on verse 36 vary wildly to mean completely different things. So, again, in the ESV, it's "who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind." There's other versions that talk about a rooster for some reason, which is like way out from what we're reading here. And other versions are talking about how God gives women skill to weave and embroider. I don't know how to make all that work. I don't know. When you have that much variance in the interpretation of this verse, that this is another one I'm going to put on the shelf and say, I don't know what's going on. Yeah, Sean? Yes. Yeah.
Terms that could go various directions.
Right. So commonly you get variants, you get variations in interpretation because of a couple of reasons. One is you may have multiple Hebrew texts where there's a little bit of a variation, and it could be just as simple as like there's some little tick mark, some little jot that's not there that was there in the other one. And that changes the meaning quite a bit. So some people will say that's the more authoritative text, I'm going with that, and others are like, I'm going to go with this. That seems like it was an error, or, you know, it was, you know, something else is going on. There's that. And then the other reason I think you see a lot of variance in interpretations can happen is because the meaning isn't clear. So you have some people who take the approach that I'm just going to translate it straight up, right? And I'm going to let people try to deal with their own interpretation of it. And then you have other people who say, well, that's not very helpful. So I'm going to try to, based on what I know about the context and about the historical context and everything that kind of goes with this, give it my best shot, you know, and then give my reasons for why I think it's to be rendered this way. So that's where you start having some deviation sometime. But again, this is one of those verses that's very unique in the whole book because there isn't this type of disagreement throughout the entire book. But occasionally you run into a verse like this where it's like, wow, is he talking about giving wisdom to man's heart? Is he talking about a rooster? Or is he talking about women embroidering? It's a delicate balance.
I think it's clearly the rooster.
Clearly the rooster. All right. The greater context of the section isn't harmed at all, though, by the differences in verse 36. You know, it's talking about God bringing rain upon the earth. So if there's a way to interpret that feeds that context, I would lean towards that. Verses 39 through 41. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their thicket? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food? So this is interesting in a couple of ways because this is the first example that we have of God going to, he's going to be talking about these different animals now as he goes and really for the rest of his response. He's basically talking about animals from this point forward. And in this first example, it kind of leads into that, but it's also a little bit unique in the sense that what's very front and center is that God is caring for his creatures, that he's providing food for them. He's helping the animals have food to eat. And you think about I can't wrap my mind around maintaining that balance in an ecosystem, right? How are you going to work all that out? But God does. And obviously I can't. Obviously Job couldn't. And I think that the bigger point is that, you know, God is working hard to take care of his creation. And what's Job going to do with that reality? That God is working hard to take care of his creation, because is not Job part of that creation as well? And I think that's where it really starts to hit home. God cares for Job, and God will provide for Job as he has, and he will take care of Job. But it's not necessarily going to be on the terms of us having an equal understanding of how everything in the universe operates, right? Job still needs to remember his place, but God is going to take care of him. It's not like what Job had asked for. Remember when Job in chapter 3, he just wanted to die. He wanted to go into a place where God wasn't. Take me to the deepest, darkest corner of the ocean and let me just die there. As far away from God as I can get is kind of the idea. And God's like, no, that's not how I operate. I don't want my creation to isolate itself from me and die alone like that. That's not how I operate. And coincidentally, isn't that kind of what the Satan wants? It wants to put that distance between God and man, and that's what this Satan was doing from the very beginning of the book of Job. It didn't like how close God was to Job and how much God regarded Job for his righteousness, and he wanted to put distance there. He said, if you put some distance between yourself and Job, he'll curse you to your face. So let's not fall into that trap if things aren't going well. I want to go ahead and move into chapter 39 a little bit, or at least, let's see. Yeah, do I? We got 5 minutes. How about we take comments and we'll save chapter 39 for next week. Yeah, Kelly.
I'm asking this question. I'd love to hear your view on this. I think as Christians, we need to be seeking to live because the information is so readily available to us. We rely upon a lot of human explanations about a whole range of things, right? Astronomy. Like we just accept, well, well, the scientists say that a light year is equal to this. And they say that this galaxy is that far away. You know what I'm saying? They just present these this information. We absorb it and largely believe it. You know, do we, in your view as Christians, rely too much upon this so-called knowledge of man and what they presume to know or not know, instead of saying, you know, there's a lot we just don't understand about this, and you need to be careful about claiming you do know so much about this?
I think,
you know what I'm saying, instead of looking at what God has obviously said and obviously revealed to us.
Yeah. I think it's going to vary from person to person. I think there are some people, like, if to your point, as Christians, some of us are leaning heavily on scientific explanations to shape our understanding of even our religion, if that's kind of where you're going.
Just really awkward. It's just a whole host of things. I mean, we would say it doesn't affect our faith in God, but at the same time, if we lay our faith and we lean on these constructs that man has erected around science, health, medicine, life, biology, that does affect how we're viewing what God is saying.
There's a lot to get into there, because, you know, not all science is equal. And I would say that probably for most of it, this is just my opinion, most people probably haven't thought a lot about it. They haven't really given a lot of consideration to how does what I learned in second grade science shape my worldview now. I think that the people who have dug into it, and I'll throw myself out there, I'm no expert in any of it, but I've looked into some of this stuff quite a bit. It's because my faith has been challenged. You know, I've been challenged by some of the arguments that have been out there, and I've had to go and research this and decide, can I still have a plausible, based on what we know and what people claim to know, especially in the secular anti-God realm, is it still plausible that God could exist? And is he still the best explanation for what we have? I've arrived at the conclusion where I am now that yes, it is. But I think that the people who have really done a lot of looking into that, they're doing it because their faith is being challenged by it. That's just my thought on it. I don't think I would have on my own, maybe some do, but out of curiosity, I would not have dug into things like physics too much. If it were just a hobby. That's just me, though. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it is a large question.
Yeah, it's a big question.
I just think sometimes, perhaps even Satan, I would argue, is saying, look, you don't have to worry about God. Be worried about the explanation for all of this.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, and I mean, if anybody, I guess let me close it off by saying, if anybody's struggling with that stuff, I've got some resources, and I'm not the only one here, but I've got some resources, and, you know, just off the top of my head, one thing that really helped me is got honestly nothing to do with the Bible or even the debate in general sometimes that you see between people of faith and people who argue the Bible isn't accurate, but things like Thomas Kuhn's A Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Because what it does is it really teaches you about the philosophy of science. Like, what is science supposed to be doing? And how are views shifted within science? And why is there resistance to change in science? And it makes it all so practical and real world. Like, science is not this big academic ball that everything all fits together. It's made up of people and ideas and motivations, just like anything else, you know? And the purpose of that book wasn't to expose science or put it on the shelf, but rather help scientists understand, look, here's why we do what we do, at least this one guy's view of it, and here's why we're so resistant to change, right? I mean, the guy, I think, was an agnostic, actually. I don't think Kuhn believed in God, but had some very interesting insights on the nature of science and the philosophy of science. So that book was helpful to me. That's not the only one. Manjit Kumar's... He did one on Einstein that was really, really helpful too. But anyway, if you want some resources, I've got resources. I know Joel has some resources too. Joel, did you have a comment too?
I was just going to say, typically when you have these discussions with people, it boils down to one question. They'll get off in love. conversation about intelligent design. That's what I did when I was challenged. And it boils down to, is there something greater than us? And the evidence, in my opinion, is overwhelmingly yes. Once you establish that there is something greater than us, then all of these side issues about the technicalities of quantum physics and dark matter and hadrons and all this kind of stuff becomes irrelevant. Because if you can say, there is someone who knows more than me that can supersede what we consider to be the natural laws, it answers all the questions. And then the other thing is if you find someone who's intellectually honest, which is rare, but I've found a couple, they will admit that all of the scientists, we know less than, we don't know more than we do.
Oh, even way more.
Age,
right.
And what we would be, considered technologically advanced society, an honest scientist will tell you, there's more that we don't know than what we do.
Yeah. Don't let me mess with your head too much, but think of like characters in a video game. If they decided they wanted to try to dig down to, okay, how did we get here and what's going on? And they came up with the technology because they had it for some reason, because it was programmed into the game that they could use their microscopes to drill down to see even inside the smallest pixel of the graphic, right? That's not going to teach them anything about the zeros and ones of the code, right? Because their construct is limited because they're a part of it, right? And that's one of the problems that science is starting to learn that it has. It can only learn so much. And it gets to the point to where it's like, now things are starting to work completely the opposite of the way they should. When you get below into the quantum realm, like Joel's kind of referencing, stuff doesn't make sense down there. It doesn't, things disappear and reappear without notice. And you learn that, like, from a material perspective, this existence isn't all that solid, okay? It's actually kind of scary. So anyway, just wanted to throw that out there. We're not in a video game, at least I don't think we are. Don't take that away from what I said. But there's lots of interesting stuff to talk about there that'll help you understand how people think, how people arrive to the conclusions that they do. And that's been supremely helpful for me. Thank you for your comments.